Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network. On Monday, February 11th, 2013, I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show and on the Progressive Radio Network every Monday live from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com.
Today we'll hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that will include: can antioxidants actually shorten life expectancy?
And what's the best way to manage tennis elbow?
And do cancer cells have a bioelectric fingerprint?
Does being married reduce the risk of a heart attack? Or cause it?
All right, good. Either way, it depends on the marriage. Can MDs feel their patient's pain?
You know, we all want the fountain of youth. Anti-aging medicine seems to be pretty big business, and people often end up taking multiple hormones and antioxidants, along with modifying their lifestyle and making sure they get enough exercise.
The anti-aging business has really gotten big because you're right. Ponce de Leon is probably still looking for that darn fountain of youth.
Yeah, everybody's trying to slow the aging process. And of course, we'd all like to look younger and feel younger. But are hormones and antioxidants the way to go? Well, with this day and age of anti-aging medicine, we have some information that throws a curveball at you. And this time it's about assumptions that are accepted as fact. And this information is probably going to upset a lot of people. But remember now, we're only the messengers. And scientists are now showing that antioxidants may be aging us and shortening our lifespan. How can this be? Aren't vitamins a good idea?
Boy, you know, that caused a lot of people to ruffle their feathers because, you know, we get polarized in medicine. We've got the mainstream people who, according to the CAM people, are the bad guys. And we've got the CAM people, according to the mainstream medicine, they're the bad guys. And it shouldn't be a war. It should be something where we present facts, where we have a conversation, where it's complementary, where we work together. Rather than having it be it's one way or it's the other, and if it's not my way, I'll be mad at you.
Well, aren't free radicals and oxidation harmful to our health?
Mm-hmm.
Well, can vitamins be harmful to our health?
Uh-huh. It sounds contradictory, doesn't it?
Well, oxidation increases free radicals with age and leads to inflammation, but antioxidants don't help with our lifespan, but they seem to decrease inflammation so that we live longer and suffer unless we don't use antioxidants.
Let's highlight what you just said.
I think we need
huge.
To start talking about, first, let's just define what antioxidants and
I want to repeat what you said because it's so important. And that's the business of if free radicals are the bad guys and antioxidants are the good guys, and we're trying to fight inflammation that's caused by free radicals, then shouldn't giving antioxidants make you better?
Yeah, well, that's the assumption.
That's the assumption. But as it turns out, the newest and latest research doesn't show that. So how do we go from here to there and have it make sense? That's what we're going to describe over the next few minutes.
Okay, so first of all, let's start out by defining what oxidation and free radicals are.
Okay, free radicals are chemicals that have a makeup that is very unstable that causes them to damage tissues. So free radicals damage tissues. They cause inflammation. It's not good for us from that point of view. Antioxidants, on the other hand, will quench or will neutralize free radicals. And that's important because then all of a sudden we've got a situation where the bad guys that are causing inflammation are being neutralized by antioxidants. So there would be a lot of people who would say that your health depends on that balance between the two. And to an extent it does, but it depends on different factors.
Well, so let's talk about the worm, the mice, and the rat studies then.
Well, that's right. See, these are very interesting. You'd think worms, who wants to study worms? We're talking about people. And aren't people different than worms?
We sort of start out looking like one.
Well, you know, what we're looking at is basic science here that doesn't come up with any absolute findings. But for the worm, it means a lot. And it may well apply to people, too. in general, we study fruit flies, we study fish, we study worms, we study all kinds of things that give us insights about how our body works. And from that, we come up with new concepts of how we're going to have people healthy.
So basically, the worms, the mice, and the rats seem to live longer with lower levels of antioxidants.
That's correct. When there's more free radical damage, and this sounds ass backwards, when there's more free radical damage and more inflammation, these creatures live longer. And you go, what? How could that be? I mean, shouldn't more free radical damage cause all kinds of problems?
Well, maybe it's because there's only a little bit of free radicals.
Well, if there's just the right amount, like baby bear's porridge, right? It's going to be fine. Because
and then what maybe do... it makes your body react and to take care of itself?
Well, here's how it works, Vicki. First of all, we need free radicals to kill microbes. So if we have an infection of some kind, our white cells kill those infection or those microbes by producing a lot of free radicals. So they engulf them and they kill them with free radicals. So you need to have that to be healthy. But the other anti-aging benefit of free radicals is they signal to the cells to repair the damage that exists in the cell. And it actually works even beyond that because it stimulates longer lifespan.
So it's part of the defense mechanism of the body.
It's a defense mechanism, but it's also something that's creating a situation where we have a better environment to live longer.
And for the body to repair itself.
The body repairs itself better, we know that. So what we have here is something that doesn't make a whole lot of sense from the point of view of the paradigm that we've been working with for quite a while. And I have to say, I bought into the antioxidant theory, absolutely. And I'm not giving it up either, because I think there are times when our antioxidants are absolutely necessary, and there are times when having free radicals are absolutely necessary. So as we were talking about infection, that's important. Without that, we would die. We wouldn't have a way of killing microbes. We've got to have a way of creating free radicals to use against them. And we also, as we age, produce more free radicals. It's not like the free radicals are causing aging. It's the other way around, according to these studies. So if that's what's happening, we have to look at free radicals in a different way. If there's a huge excess of free radicals, we're going to get sick. We know it causes cancer and it causes
arteriosclerosis,
absolutely,
and organ damage.
It's the basis for the model of all the chronic diseases we have.
So the free radicals, they may be the consequence rather than the cause.
Of aging. Yes. As we age, we're not able to control the production of free radicals as much.
Unless they're in large amounts.
Well, if they're in too large amounts, then we're going to age a little faster in one dimension. But as we said earlier, if we go ahead and we expose worms and mice to high levels of free radicals, they live longer and substantially longer. It might be as much as 50% longer for the worm, for example, if you exposed it to a pesticide.
It sounds like immunity, where small insults might help us to withstand the big ones.
Well, if you little by little give people something that stimulates the immune system, it will be able to react in a way that's bigger, particularly if it's repeatedly assaulted by those things. So, yes, there's a similarity there, but no, it's a different mechanism. So what we're looking at is a very interesting setup.
Well, haven't they also found in this study or one of these studies that the free radicals also turn on a cellular repair gene?
Yeah, absolutely. There was good information about that kind of surprised everybody because we didn't expect that. But we look at what it does. I mean, that's what the bottom line is. So there were some studies that were done that showed that it actually turns on a gene called HIF-1 that is responsible for activating a number of genes involved in cellular repair. So now all of a sudden it's being complicated, and the rules that we have created are only correct sometimes. We have to look at the whole spectrum of what a cell is exposed to before we decide whether some particular activity, like producing free radicals, is good or bad.
Well, like exercise, for example, that creates free radicals.
Absolutely.
But they say that it's better to not take antioxidants.
Well,
because the small amounts of the free radicals are good for building muscle.
That's right, but only to a point.
But then the large amounts, what happens then?
Then here's the example that will explain it. If you go out and you train to become an athlete and you gradually increase the amount of exercise you do, you're gradually going to increase the amount, number of free radicals that are produced. That will stimulate your muscle cells to hypertrophy. They will grow. They will be bigger. They'll be stronger. But if you're a weakened warrior, okay, and so one, you're not exercising much, and then you decide to run a marathon, I mean, obviously, all kinds of things are going to break down.
You get some injuries and inflammation.
There,
and
the amount of free radicals that are formed are overwhelming, and that's going to lead to breakdown. It's not going to lead to buildup. So it depends on how you go about doing it. So this concept of what a free radical is and how it works and its effect, its biological effect, depends on the situation.
Well, then also inflammation can cause the free radicals, like with X-rays, for example.
Yes.
And what happens with X-rays?
Well, X-rays always cause tissue damage. They cause inflammation. That's not good.
Doesn't
and
it
in
also
that setting, you want to use antioxidants because it'll protect against more free radical damage. In fact, it may save your life. There have been studies on rats where they give them a lethal dose of radiation and all the rats die. But if they just give them 2 grams of vitamin C, which for their size is quite a bit, they don't. So antioxidants, are they good or bad? Free radicals, are they good or bad? The answer is they're both.
And everything's about balance, isn't it?
This whole thing is about balance.
Well, then toxins also would cause free radicals. That's why it's important to have our environment cleaned up. But there was a weird study with some of these worms where they put them in herbicides, and what happened then?
Well, they lived longer, okay? And they
that's
weren't
so crazy.
Well, see, you've got a balance here where if you stimulate the body with free radicals, that it helps with living longer, but it also produces more free radicals, which don't interfere with
length
of life.
So you live longer and feel terrible.
Well, you might. It depends on whether or not you build up your body's natural antioxidant system. See, there are antioxidants we take in the form of food. There are antioxidants that we create inside of our body with certain enzymes. And there are antioxidants that we take in pill form. The pill form is not the best way to go unless the situation is unusual. If you expected a lot of radiation from Fukushima, if you live there, or from an expected bomb that was going off, you would want to take a ton of vitamin C, all you could, because you want to protect against that damage. In that setting, antioxidants are fine. You may not live longer because of that, but you may be able to live, period, because it's helping. I mean, look at your situation when you were sick. We had you on 60 grams of vitamin C a day. Now, that probably is not going to increase your lifespan when you do that, because we know that that's, at least if you're a worm or a mouse, it's not going to happen. But what it did do was save your life from the point of view of the reactions that were occurring that were allergic that might have killed you. So
antioxidants may be good, and they may not always be good.
Yeah.
And it's something for people to be aware of, because it could be a problem with 52% of the people in the United States of Americans on them.
Well, see, that's right. And that's an issue that we should look at.
And a lot of people take an awful lot of them. And, you know, we do have a problem with our food supply. Not all of our food supply is fresh, and
that's
it's
right.
Not all as healthy as it could be because
right.
of processing or
okay.
transportation to get it to the store and all that sort of thing. So this is why a lot of people believe that it's good to supplement.
Well, the logic is, in fact, it makes plenty of sense, but is it the best way to go?
I know, like you always make that example about eating a whole orange.
Yeah, right. You eat the whole food. If it looks like a watermelon or a zucchini or an orange, eat it. If it comes in a pill form, or it comes in some other kind of package with all kinds of ingredients in it, that's not food anymore.
Of course, some things are not good to eat? Like, for example, fish. Now, fish oil, I don't think is an antioxidant, is it?
Oh, sure it is.
Oh, okay, so good. Yeah. Okay, so that's a good example.
Uh-huh.
Well, a lot of fish has mercury in it.
Yeah, well, that's
so
right.
So if you can take the fish oil supplement that's purified, then you don't have to worry about the mercury.
Okay, but let's go back to the basic premise here. Do you want to play catch-up, or do you want to do it right from the start? And what I mean by that, you're going to assume you've got bad food that doesn't have much nutrition in it, so you're going to take all these supplements, or are you going to go back, and are you going to fix it so the food is good?
And we need to fix the food, you're right. Get at the cause.
Okay, so grow your own, maybe? I mean, who can't grow a little something, even if they live in an apartment, you know, where there's a little deck? You can do a lot.
I got some work for you to do this weekend.
Uh-oh. Me and my big mouth. Well, that's right. Or you can go to farmers markets, but you want to eat food. You want to do the best that you can that way. And if you're having trouble, you can always juice. I mean, juice is the most concentrated way of providing what the food has in it that's the best. You will never be able to recreate what nature has done to make food. So we're going back to a premise here that says lifestyle is what's really important. It's what you eat. It's how much you rest. It's how much exercise you get. It's your stress reduction. It's your weight. It's your meaningful purpose in life. It's not about the pills that you're going to take, okay, that are going to supply what's not in the food. It's not about trying to make more free radicals so you live longer. It's about being in balance with nature.
Exactly. And certain antioxidants can actually increase the death risk by 16%.
Well, that's right.
And some of these vitamins that can shorten the lifespan came out to be vitamin E and beta carotene.
All right.
And now beta carotene is in almost all multiple vitamins.
Well, see, that's why, you know, I'm an orthomolecular doctor. What does that mean? It means that I've studied nutrition for a lot of years, and I know a fair amount about cell biochemistry, and I try to treat some of the illnesses that are presenting in my patients using natural approaches that rely on food and on supplements. But I'm not a big believer in taking a lot of supplements. I don't take a lot of supplements. I think you need some vitamin D because our lifestyle doesn't get us back out in the sun. And because we've migrated to different parts of the planet rather than from where we originally started out, where we were in balance. You take somebody who's black and put them at the North Pole, they're gonna have vitamin D deficiencies that's huge. You take somebody that lives at the North Pole and put them on the equator, they're going to burn up from all the things that come from that radiation. So you have to look at the whole story. Try to keep natural the best you can. Take as few things that are medications or supplements, because you're going to get yourself into trouble with information that comes out like this that throws a monkey wrench in the whole thing.
Well, everybody needs to realize that aging is complex. So would you say that it's best to only take vitamins if you have a deficiency?
No, I wouldn't say that. But a lot of people would come to that conclusion. So the American Dietetic Association and the American Heart Association have come out and taken a polar stance that says that they don't think we should take anything in amounts that are more than what are recommended to prevent certain kinds of diseases like scurvy and pellagra. That's nonsense, because we know that the nutrients that are in our environment can be concentrated and they can have a powerful effect to help people who have certain diseases. So both positions are wrong. That's why when we started this conversation, my comment was, we need to work together. We need to do integrative medicine. That's why health medicine's first principle is integrative. And for those of you who want to know the other three, it's about doing holistic medicine, where you look at the whole person. It's about being person-centered, and it's about prevention. That is the definition of health medicine. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. It's time for Nurse Vicki's first 2020 tip on new ways to prevent tooth decay. And when we come back, we'll be talking about what's the best way to manage a tennis elbow.
Research shows that coconut may combat tooth decay. And tooth decay is the breakdown of tooth enamel that protects our teeth. It's a major health problem affecting 90% of Americans over age 20. And the reason that we're talking about this is not only to have good teeth, but poor oral health is linked to heart disease and diabetes and even strokes. So
lots of inflammation there. That's right.
Yeah, it's important to take good care of our teeth, and coconut oil may keep tooth decay at bay.
Cool.
Now scientists have found that coconuts kill plaque-causing bacteria, and they're effective germ fighters. And this is really important in lieu of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Now, one strain of coconut extracts have even been shown to kill one strain of herpes virus. And coconut oil also has antifungal effects, especially for Candida albicans that causes the oral thrush and the yeast infections. This is impressive considering that antibiotics are not effective against viruses and fungi. Now, the Irish study implies that it could be used in dental products like toothpaste and mouthwash, and it might also be good to incorporate coconut oil into some of our sugary treats since they're a major cause of tooth decay and cavities. Not only does this make for good food for thought, but another study came out about xylitol. Now, xylitol is a natural sweetener from birch, and it has half the glycemic index of sugar, and it's not only sweet, but it's successful in reducing cavities, especially in children and adolescents. Now, xylitol's main benefit is that it's got an alkalizing ability to protect our teeth from acidity and sugars. So go for a xylitol toothpaste or mints or gum after eating or drinking. And remember that acidity is from plaque and foods and drinks that lower our oral pH. And acidic saliva can be due also to hormonal changes in pregnancy and stress, and meds or depressed immune system. Xylitol can loosen that plaque, and it can be helpful for a dry mouth. I was thinking last night of mixing some xylitol with coconut oil and a little bit of baking soda and then brushing my teeth with that.
What a good idea.
Because, you know, toothpaste can be loaded with toxins.
Oh, it is.
And it's hard to find really good toothpaste.
And what's wrong with making your own? That's a great idea.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna do that.
Make some for me, too.
Okay. We have an epidemic of tooth decay and gum disease in this country and probably all over the world. So it's important to have good oral health with good dental hygiene, including brushing and flossing and avoiding the sweets, unless maybe they have some coconut and xylitol.
Okay.
So you can experiment with that and see if it makes a difference, and then you can just smile pretty.
Oh, that's nice. Great tip. Thank you.
We've all heard the term tennis elbow.
Yes. I've had a few of those in my career.
Yes, tennis can cause tremendous pain on the inside or the outside of the elbow, but so can lifting weights and manual labor, like painting or putting in new floors and that kind of thing.
Sure.
But, you know, I know who helped you the most with your tennis elbow was your tennis coach.
Well, that's really true. You know, and that points out what this article really should be talking about. When I see people making a detached look at a solution to a problem, meaning that they're only looking at what they can do to heal the tissues without looking at the big picture, meaning, how did somebody get it in the first place? How do tennis players get a tennis elbow? I can tell you it's by using the wrist late. So that if you're hitting a – okay. What you know, most people, they hit a tennis ball, they use their arm. They stand there and they just swing their arm. But the pros who hit a tennis ball, there's very little arm action actually compared to getting their weight into the shot. And it's
using their body more.
Using their body. When you do that – and your arm is only really kind of like attached to your shoulder and you're letting it swing through freely. Now you're talking about taking the stress off the elbow and the wrist, which are the problems that develop that can lead to tennis elbow. So what's the point of fixing a tennis elbow if you don't know what caused it? And you might say, well, at least it gets me so I'm out of pain. Right. But if you're going to try something like a steroid injection, wrong.
Well, we've all heard that cortisone injections can relieve the pain.
Exactly.
For the short term. And now this new study shows that steroid injections alone or with physical therapy don't last. And yet physical therapy alone for up to a year can be effective. But this is why we need to talk about the answer for short recovery.
Well,
we don't want to be doing this for a whole year.
That's right. Well, they want the quick fix. Who doesn't want the quick fix? I know when I've had my tennis elbows, I did have an injection. And yes, it did work. And it worked within a couple of days. And I was back to my normal game.
So but you then, were lucky.
Yeah, well, I'm like a pro at tennis, too. I mean, I played the tennis circuit and senior tennis for 25 years, so it's not like I'm a club player. And what I did is I changed my technique a little bit so that it wasn't so much a wristy thing and an arm thing. It was about how to move my body into the ball and have very little in the way of an arm swing. That may not make sense to people that aren't tennis players. In fact, it won't make sense to a lot of people who are tennis players, particularly at the club level. But my coach at the time, possibly the best coach in the world at that time, old Jack Shaw, an Australian, who's coached people like Rod Laver and others who are top tennis players.
Colin Dibley.
Yeah, lots of people, about 50 of them, okay? And what he saw that I had a tennis elbow, and I said, you know, I don't even think I can play today. I can't hold the racket. He says, just do what I tell you and see what happens. He says, hold the racket loosely, swing the racket through the shot with your shoulder, and don't hit it at all, which means your arm is like a piece of dead meat, and you're just turning your shoulder to hit the ball.
No wonder so many tennis players get a bad shoulder.
Well, it actually doesn't give you a bad shoulder that way, but I understand what you're saying. There are other ways to make a shoulder decompensate, and usually that's from a serve that's used by just using your arm again.
So that's another topic.
So you have to – my coach, see, was better than an orthopedist who would have said, well, we can fix that with an injection, or we could actually go in there and scrape all that stuff off of the tennis elbow bone and repair this. It'll take a few weeks, you know, to recover. He said, no, you don't need to do any of that. Change what you're doing. And that's where we miss out. And we're talking about alignment now. How do you get the alignment right? You talk about people whose hips go out and knees go out and backs go out and shoulders and elbows and all this. It's a lot of it's about alignment.
Well, can a chiropractor help with a tennis elbow?
A lot more than anybody else if that chiropractor understands something about the fundamentals of a tennis swing. Mm-hmm. But you have to have all this put together or it's only doing pieces of it. It's like, okay, so you fix the alignment, then you and the pain goes away and you've healed, and then you go back out on the tennis court and you do the same thing again. What do you think is going to happen? From time to time, it's going to come back.
Okay, so you have the inflammation. Mm-hmm. What do you do? How do you treat the inflammation? I mean, the steroids seem to slow the healing.
Well, steroids.
They decrease the inflammation.
Okay, so they're good because they reduce inflammation, and that's really important. And that's why we all think, should I have a steroid injection? But what they don't do is speed up healing. And in fact, what they do is they markedly slow it down. And that's why your orthopedist is telling you maybe you can have two or three steroid injections in your hip or your back or your knee or your elbow or wherever you have this problem that's creating pain. But after that, the joint's going to be a mess.
Okay, so they were talking about physical therapy, and they made it sound like if you did physical therapy alone that it could take up to a year.
That's the problem.
What do you
Who wants
do?
To take a
what
year
What do
off?
You do, and how long does it take to do what you do?
Oh, well, I use the light therapy, okay? But that's just as silly as any other treatment from the point of view.
Okay, so first you have to get at the cause, improve your swing. Okay,
right?
So but you still have – you're hurting
yeah.
while you're learning to fix your swing.
Okay, here's a story that will tell you exactly what happened to me. I was going to play the World Championships in singles in Australia, and I had a tennis elbow at the time. And I was having enough trouble with it that I thought I would try and find a replacement. So what happened is I used the light therapy for a week, doing it twice a day for about 15 minutes, and I was able to have complete relief from it. I changed a little something about my swing and went back and won the world title in singles. That's what happens with a powerful treatment like this that works better than a steroid because, yes, it will relieve the pain, and usually in a matter of a few minutes. Like when I put the light on for about 5 or 10 minutes each time I did that, it took care of all the pain that I had, and over a week, it went away completely. But it also speeds up the healing process. So compared to a steroid, it's like night and day. But the
Plus
problem
it doesn't
is,
hurt, and there's no downside.
Right. There's no problem with that. Yet, who's doing it? Almost nobody.
Your patients.
Yeah. Well, if you do infrared scans, you can see where the inflammation is. You can treat that in real time with some of the LEDs that we use that are very sophisticated lights. I have one machine that puts out light that costs $500,000. Talking about now a very sophisticated way of delivering light of a certain frequency in many different ways. So this is a big thing, and we should be looking at that rather than looking at what we are in terms of steroid injections, which after a year don't work any better than placebo. Okay, it's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicky. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio, and we'll be talking about, do cancer cells have a bioelectric fingerprint, and what does that mean? So stay tuned for more Prescriptions for Health Radio. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicky.
We have some exciting news about detecting cancer. We already know that trained dogs can detect cancer by sniffing, and spectrophotometers can identify cancer by measuring light emissions in breath and urine. And now, bioelectric signatures can help not only identify cancer cells, but change the signals to stop the cancer and prevent its spread. So how does this work?
That's just amazing, isn't it? When you think of how complex the human body is, and we have all these remarkable different ways to assess what's going on, imagine a dog sniffing and saying, there's cancer in there. And we know that that's true because Michael Brofman did some studies on women who had breast cancer. And he published his studies in medical journals showing that they could identify those women who had cancer and those that didn't. Very powerful. And then to use a spectrophotometer, which, of course, is just measuring light emissions that come from tissues, like in the lung. We know that studies have been done on the breath that comes out, can tell us a lot about what's in there in terms of cancer. And the same thing with urine. So the body is giving all kinds of signals that tell us whether or not we have cancer or we don't. And now the idea of looking at the membrane potential, the electrical charge that's on the surface of a cell, can tell us whether or not this tissue is going to develop into a cancer or not, is a remarkable thing.
Because I guess the cancer cells have different electrical frequencies than normal tissue.
Exactly.
So that's why you call it a bioelectric fingerprint.
Exactly, because it's specific to each one. And so what they discovered is this bioelectrical signal can identify the cells that are likely to develop into tumors and actually lower the incidence of cancer cells turning into cancer by manipulating the electrical charge across the membrane. I mean, that's a big deal because the electrical events actually tell cells what to do.
It sure sounds a lot safer than doing chemotherapy and radiation.
Well, if you wait and it develops into a cancer, you know, we know stage 4 cancer survival at 5 years is in the range of 2%. It'd be a heck of a lot better to do what I would call the earliest detection.
Yeah, early detection.
Okay, that we could. It's almost like prevention, but it's not prevention and should be carefully separated from it, because when you're picking up something early, it tells you that there's something going wrong in this cell that's a big deal, and there's a lot of biochemistry that needs to be changed, usually by lifestyle. I mean, look at the things that change our risk for developing chronic diseases.
Well, they're also able to do other things with these electrical frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they could repair and slow the growth and spread, you know, and the spread.
Well, that's what they found. They found that by manipulating the membrane voltage, that they could regulate the cellular behavior by changing the amount of growth that was going to be there, the ability of a cell to migrate, or even change the shape of the cell. And they can induce changes that cause the cell to repair and even whole organs to repair. So
this is great. It sounds like everything in one. It can identify the cancer, and then it can prevent it from spreading.
Right. Now, this was all done.
And repair it.
This was done in animals, and animals are different, and they're not people. But this is sort of like one of those signs that tells us that there's another way to look at this. I mean, we tend to react to problems after they develop, rather than be proactive at creating a situation where we're not likely to get into trouble. And this is all about lifestyle. It's about the environment. It's about how we interact with it. It's how we can set up a situation where we can flourish. And if we go back to how Mother Nature set things up, we've had tens of thousands of years to adapt to Mother Nature. And all of a sudden, in the last 100 years or so, we've made another 100,000 chemicals that are now polluting the environment.
Giving everybody cancer.
Well, cancer and all
these
chronic...
Not everybody, but you know, a lot of people.
Well, I would say everybody is
getting... Because we do get cancer cells that come and go. And...
Absolutely. I mean, you do biopsies on women who are age 50 who have died from traffic accidents or something else. And then, and about 50% of those women, maybe it's closer to 30%, 30% of those women will actually have an invasive cancer, okay, that's a real cancer. And yet we know that 30% of those women aren't going to die from cancer. So we know that it cancer comes and goes, but it's there. And all of us are making cancer cells. And if we did something to be more natural about how we live our lives and had a healthy lifestyle, this wouldn't be as much of an issue. So we have to go back to look at what we're doing and assess what lifestyle is all about. Does what you eat make a difference? You bet. How about stress? Sure. How about how much sleep you get? Yeah.
How about the toxins in your house?
Absolutely. All the toxins all over the environment. You know, if you miss...
Yeah, but there are certain things that we can do ourselves individually, and that's to, at least to try to keep them out of our house.
Well, we do the best.
And out of our mouth.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, we need to do that, but let's look at this thing from the point of view of how do you fix the situation? You don't pollute the environment first. You don't make chemicals that aren't well tested on animals or whatever, and just put them in the environment or sell them as products, because you wind up with an epidemic of chronic diseases like we have now. I mean, 50% of America has a chronic disease. That's a bad track record. Can you imagine what it would be like to not have these chronic diseases? Think of all the money that would be saved. Think about how much money we could spend on those people who are unfortunate enough to have problems develop with their health. From accidents or from genetic problems or from some other mishap that happens. We'd have a healthcare system that didn't spend $2.8 trillion a year that largely supports an industry rather than people. And that's what's happened. So we have to find a way to undo the trouble that we've created, or we're going to pollute ourselves into an epidemic that's even bigger.
Well, you know, a lot of people think that a lot of these airplanes that are flying over us that are making these trails behind them.
Well, there's a lot of controversy about what a chemtrail is and what a contrail is. A contrail being the condensed water vapor that leaves a trail behind an airplane. And a chemtrail, which is people deliberately putting chemicals in the environment and spreading it that way.
And why do we just accept that, and why is that being done?
Well, I don't know that I want to get into that on this show. All the conspiracy theories can be looked up. Go to Prison Planet, you know, and read some of their stuff. It's incredible stuff. Alex Jones has done a great job. Or go to Mike Adams at Natural News and read some of the stuff that they have on this. And they don't hold anything back, and it makes you really wonder what the heck is happening in our culture. Are we oriented to try and help people, or are we just really in the business of trying to make more money for the rich and have more people who are poor, which is exactly what's happening? So we're looking at health care. I mean, it's easy to fix the problems we have in health care. We just have to have somebody or have a culture that wants to do that.
And then all the genetically engineered foods
All kinds of just silly things.
Extra pesticides, spraying Roundup at the kids' schools and their playground.
Well, if our first segment was right, maybe spraying Roundup will make them live longer. You know,
well.
You have to look. Well, you know, we get very opinionated about things like that. And when you start talking about things that are negative in that way, we all look like we're the bad guy. But you have to have an open mind, and you have to take a careful look at these things, because if you don't, you're simply going to miss out on things that you should be looking at, because the data is suggesting that it needs to be dealt with. So when we go back to looking at cancer and now seeing that we can sniff it, we can detect it by light frequencies, or we can detect it by electrical impulses that are the membrane potential of a cell, we're making real progress at dealing with how to cope with what's happening in our environment.
In safer ways.
Well, that's true. But what we are not doing is the prevention that needs to be done. and to clean up the toxic exposures that are in our environment, because a lot of those things are what are causing all these problems. So do you want early detection, or do you want not to get sick in the first place? If you figure that out,
prevention
through lifestyle is medicine of the future. That's real health care reform. Okay, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Spooter here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on the regrets of the dying. And when we come back, we'll be talking about, does being married reduce the risk of a heart attack? And after that, can MDs feel their patient's pain? Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Talking about the top five regrets of the dying. A palliative nurse has recorded the most common regrets of the dying, and among the top ones is, I wish I hadn't worked so hard. So I want you to be asking yourself what your biggest regret would be if this was your last day of life. There was no mention of more sex or bungee jumps. A palliative nurse who was counseling the dying in their last days revealed the most common regrets that we have at the end of our lives. Bonnie Ware, she's an Australian nurse, and she spent several years working in palliative care, caring for patients in the last 12 weeks of their lives, and she recorded their dying epiphanies and to a book called The Top Five Regrets of the Dying. So she writes of this phenomenal clarity of vision that people gain at the end of their lives and how we might learn from their wisdom. And some of the common themes surfaced again and again. So these are the five regrets that she witnessed. The first one is, I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. So this was the most common regret of all. And when people realize that their life is almost over and they look back clearly on it, it's easy to see how many dreams have gone unfulfilled. And most people hadn't honored even half of their dreams, and they had to die knowing that it was due to the choices that they made or not made. So health brings a freedom that very few realize until they no longer have it. I was thinking, like, you know, if you're a parent, it's important to love being a parent. And to take some time out and to fulfill, you know, your bucket list. The second one was, I wish I hadn't worked so hard. Now, this came from every male patient that she nursed. They missed their children's youth and their partner's companionship. And women also spoke of the regret, but most were from an older generation, and many of the female patients hadn't been breadwinners. And all of the men that she nursed deeply regretted spending so much of their lives on the treadmill of a work existence. So if you've got a family, you know, spend some time with them. If you love your work, you know, I mean, that's really an important thing. And so much of life, I think, is about time. Like, we feel so short on time all the time. So make what you're doing important. The third one was, I wish I had the courage to express my feelings. Many people, you know, suppress their feelings in order to keep peace with others. And as a result, they settled for mediocre existence and they never became who they were truly capable of becoming. And many people developed illnesses related to the bitterness and resentment that they carried as a result of this. I think everybody can speak to that. We don't always say what we really are thinking. And the fourth one was, I wish I'd stayed in touch with my friends. You know, often they would not truly realize the full benefits of old friends until their dying weeks, and it wasn't always possible to track them down. And many became so caught up in their own lives that they had to let their golden friendships slip by over the years. There were many deep regrets about not giving friendships the time and the effort that they deserved. And everybody misses their friends when they're dying. So you need to make time to be with your friends. I wish that I'd let myself be happier. That was the last one. This is surprisingly common because many didn't realize until the end that happiness is a choice. They'd stayed stuck in old patterns and habits, and the so-called comfort of familiarity overflowed into their emotions as well as into their physical lives. Fear of change had them pretending to others and to themselves that they were content, when deep within they longed to laugh properly and have silliness in their life again. So this is when it's time for you to ask yourself, what's your greatest regret so far, and what will you do to set out to achieve or to change that before you die.
That is a beautiful tip, Vicki. An absolutely beautiful tip. And it actually tells a story of what life is about. You know, when we're on our deathbed, we don't think about our bank accounts. We don't think about how much we have in the way of gold or assets. What we're thinking about is the relationships in our life. And did we get as much out of them? Did we give as much as we could? Did we live in a way that was loving? Were we creative in doing that? And that's a huge thing. And then the business of being authentic, which is what you're talking about here. Being authentic is a huge thing because it means you're being who you are, not just being honest about what you say. Integrity is certainly one aspect of authenticity, but it's only the minor player. The real player is that when you're really truly being authentic, you're letting your feelings known without censoring them. You're having the self-confidence of that little child that lives inside that's got these yearnings and things that it wants to do is really understanding what needs to be expressed at the deepest level.
Well, the thing is being heard. You see, yeah. You can express what you think and sometimes...
Well, you have to say it first. If you can say it, you're being authentic. And if you can create boundaries, you're actually bringing it into reality as a way that people will treat you.
So it's important to let go of that fear of saying what you think and what you feel.
I don't know of anything that's much more important than what you just talked about in those five little sections of your tip. Thank you so much. And if our listeners will pay attention to that, it will enrich their lives immensely.
So it's not new that marriage can be stressful if you're happy.
Can apply those five things to our marriage, can't we?
That can reduce your stress.
We can increase it,
happy.
Too. Yeah, that's right.
And we reported on a study showing that marriage reduces the risk of a heart attack in men. And now a study shows that it can reduce the risk and the prognosis of a heart attack in both men and women. So why do you think that marriage is associated with cardiovascular disease?
Well, associated in a way where there's really not as much of an association. I think that marriage is something that we need. We need to have a relationship where we're comfortable, we're confident, we can express ourselves to be who we are, we can be authentic, and we should be spending more time together. You know, you and I are always talking about this. How much work should we do, and how much time should we spend for ourselves? And it's an issue we haven't really fully resolved because we're getting satisfaction from both. I know both of us do a lot of work to prepare for these shows. We do a lot of work to do our website at drsubhuta.com, which has now more than 2,300 audios and videos that we've made. You'd have to say we were a bit of a workaholic in making that happen. But at the same time, what we have produced from that is immensely important, and it's a gift to humanity. And it's a free website, by the way, that you all should visit because it's got 33 health assessments on it, which means that you take a little test for about four or five minutes at the most that are yes or no or in multiple choice. And what comes back is it tells you about your cholesterol problem or your problem with heart disease or cancer or whatever else that you have. And again, all free. So the point that we're making here is not just an advertisement. It's about, do you really feel fulfilled from your work? Is it your self-expression at the deepest level?
Well, see, what can happen is you can end up being, like you said, workaholics, and then it takes away from that.
Yeah, it does. If it becomes just a job, you know, you have to have a balance in life. We don't have as much as we should have. I'm the first one to admit it. And yet trying to change that is difficult because there's just the two of us doing the work of a site like Mercola's or a site like the Health Ranger or Gary Null's. And there are just two of us creating all this stuff. So go to the site, have a look, take advantage of it. And maybe it'll help you to, you know, work out your own stresses. There are assessments on depression and anxiety and sleep and all that business.
Well, anyway, back to being married.
Yeah, right.
They found that people that were married had better health habits, and maybe it's because they have more support in calling 911. You know, they have somebody else that can call it for them.
Uh-huh.
There's better treatment for a person after they're being discharged from the hospital, I guess because they've got somebody to take care of them and to watch after them.
Well, to remind them, you know, because a lot of the time we don't want to do some of the things that our doctors tell us.
They're not as lonely. They have healthier meals. They have a partner. They have a lover.
Yeah, well, this is all big stuff.
They also found that people with poor health were more prone to getting divorced.
Yeah.
Maybe I guess that would make you irritable.
Well, you know, I've seen some marriages that really disappointed me where the woman developed breast cancer and the man took off. And
it's I've heard of that so many
what
times.
What kind of a relationship was that? Maybe it was a blessing
that
she got cancer and got rid of him because the marriage couldn't have been too good to start with.
Well, stress can be a problem, too, with relationship problems, and that could increase your risk of a heart attack.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about what stress does to the cardiovascular system, because I think a lot of this is about stress.
Well, you're right. I mean, it certainly gets it geared up, and we have problems with hypertension. We have headaches from it. I mean, a lot of smoke because of that. There are a whole lot of things that cause a lot of inflammation from the free radicals we were talking about earlier that are definitely a negative thing. And it's unequivocal in our literature that if you're under more free radical stress, that you're going to have more challenges in the way of arteriosclerosis or cancer or other diseases like that. So this whole business of marriage, really, if it's a good marriage, it's a reflector of what people were made to do. We were made to be couples. And to work with one another and to share our lives and support one another and be there in times when, you know, things are not going right and not just be, you know, a fair weather friend like so often is the case with some of the friendships that we have. Marriage is a deeper relationship.
Okay. So, you know, so often with HMO medicine, we hear that doctors rush their patients in and out of their offices and they don't take the time to listen and to be present with their patients, which is why the study on doctor empathy is so important. Is so encouraging. A patient's relationship with his or her doctor is an important valued component of the healing. And now scientific evidence with brain scans show that doctors actually can feel their patient's pain and the patient's relief after the treatment. And I know that this isn't new to you. So talk about what you feel when you're treating your patients with a photon stimulator, for example.
Oh, yeah. It's a hands-on thing. It's being connected with them. It's about doing a lot with intention. When I'm there and I'm treating somebody with light and I'm watching it in real time on the imager that we have that shows the heat patterns on the surface of the skin, I'm deeply engaged with what's happening, and my intention has a very powerful effect on both me and what I can deliver in terms of my own heartfelt energy to my patient.
Well, you know, with Reiki, a lot of that is about intention. That's energy type healing, the intention of love. So it really is so important. I thought what was interesting about this study, though, is that it shows how it affects the doctors, that when the doctors empathize with the patients, the doctors are more satisfied. So it's not just the patient's reaction.
Well, that's right. There's a dance that occurs between the doctor and the patient. We're really just two human beings who are interested in achieving a certain outcome with a health issue. And we have to keep in mind that physical disease is the body's way of expressing psycho-spiritual dis-ease. That's an important enough statement that I want to repeat it. Physical disease is the somatic or physical expression of psycho-spiritual dysfunction. That being the case, then the relationship that we have that deals with intention and deals with the deepest issues at the psycho-spiritual level of the patient is where the action is.
And the doctor's expectations influence the patient's outcome.
Huge. I know that's true because I've seen some interesting placebo effects sometimes that occur. You know, when we use our light, for example, it's sometimes I'll do a placebo treatment with someone. You can't tell when the light's on or off.
Well, I know you said you had that happen by an accident.
It happened by mistake once, and I was astounded at what happened. So I've done it from time to time as a placebo, and I get the same result a lot of the time because I think you can train somebody's physiology and biochemistry to respond to what you teach when you use this device. And yet when we do our double-blinded placebo-controlled studies, the light works. We know that beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Well, I know one time you brought one home that was a little different. And you told me to try it.
Oh, yeah, and it didn't work.
And I said, it doesn't work. Well, and you were telling me, oh, this is really good. This is a new one and everything, and that didn't work. But when I used yours, the real one, it did. So.
All right, we're at the end of the show. We'd like to remind you that we'll be back to talk live about what's new in the news in health and take your health questions every Monday morning on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on DrSaputo.com as well as PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on DrSaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Thanks for being with us. We'll see you next time. Have a great week.